Good morning. Please be seated. The first case on our oral argument calendar today is Ernesto Gonzalez v. State, 64249. Always good to see Mr. Cornell and Mr. McCarthy back. Mr. Cornell, are you ready to proceed?
I'm ready, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, my name is Richard Cornell and I represent the appellant, Ernesto Gonzalez. This strikes me as a case with an awful lot of good issues worthy of in-bank consideration. And in 15 minutes, I doubt I'm going to hit all of them. I'll try. Or most of them. But it strikes me as I look at this case that the issues in the main are overridden by what I would call two philosophic observations. And the first one is this. If the Vagos, and for that matter the Hells Angels, are outlaw motorcycle gangs who come into town and terrorize people and maraud and this sort of thing, why then has Street Vibrations gone on so long in Reno and Sparks? It's about to go on in 3 weeks. Not only is it about to go on, we now have it twice a year in the spring and in the fall. Are Reno and Sparks really that blasé about public safety, or is something else going on? Is it possible that all of this has been overhyped in a little bit, you know, in shows like Sons of Anarchy relative to the sinister mob syndicate? What really is driving this? The second philosophic observation I have is this. If Vago Ernesto Gonzalez had been Sparks Police Department Officer Gonzalez and did exactly what the video shows that Gonzalez did, would he have been prosecuted for murder? And I'll give you the answer to that. The answer is no. And the reason why is clearly revealed from the testimony of Detective Sergeant Walsh. Unfortunately, I didn't reference this in the brief, but if you look at AAV 13, page 3061, you see that she's the one who comes on the scene after the shooting of Pettigrew. And she has her AR-15 out and tells Villagrana to drop it. And she said, had he continued to point the gun at as he was, she would have shot him. Why? For the public safety. That tells me that what Ernesto Gonzalez did, as captured on the video only, is not necessarily illegal. And that's, of course, the big issue that one of the big issues we're here to talk about. But that informs issues 2, 3, and 6, and neither of these observations inform issue 1. Issue 1 is a standalone issue, but certainly an issue that warrants in-bank consideration. What happens on issue 1 is this. This case clearly was centered on a conspiracy theory. That is clear from the charging documents. And during the deliberations, a juror asked this question. If a person has no knowledge of a conspiracy, but their actions contribute to someone's plan, are they guilty of a conspiracy? Both attorneys immediately answer the question, no, both the prosecutor and the defense attorney. And certainly, jury instruction 17 implies that the answer is no, and certainly jury instruction 17 is a correct statement of the law. But it doesn't make it explicit to the jury, which of course is why the juror asked the question, and we know from Brooks v. State and Garcia v. State that the answer to that question absolutely is no. Now, does Tellis v. State in 1968 give the district court judge the ability just to say, refer to the instructions as given and no other instructions on every question? I don't believe this court meant Tellis to say that. And the reason I say that is because everywhere else in the country, it goes like this. If the jury is asking a question like that on the basic element of the charge, the linchpin of the charge, you have to answer the question as long as it's answerable. And that result, I would submit to you, is implied from the Supreme Court case of Bollenbach. And I would submit that that's the direction, I think, that this court was going a few years ago in Lamb. Everything else I can say about that issue is stated in the briefs, but I do have one observation. Judge Steinheimer, in the end, and I think the state here says, well, that was a question from one juror. Sure, but it only takes one juror to hang a jury and avoid a judgment of conviction. And moreover, we don't know if that juror was asking that question for himself or if he was asking that question for the benefit of the other 11, hoping that the answer might come back the way he suspected. We just don't know. But that fact, I would submit to you, does not make, if you find there's error, and I submit you should, that fact would keep you from finding that the error is harmless. With respect to issue two, this is a great issue. And this case, I think, gives this court the perfect opportunity to explain NRS 200.160. I will admit that, unfortunately, I inherit a record that to reach it the way I hope you'd reach it, you have to reach it as plain error. But per Carter and Crawford and Sanchez-Dominguez, I would think you would, because this was the defense, was defense of others. It's interesting. Nevada is 150 years old. NRS 200.160 and its NCL counterpart is as old as Nevada itself, and yet we really don't have a good case out of this court interpreting that statute. But the point is, as the statute we submit should be interpreted, it's not the same thing as self-defense. And particularly it's not the same thing as self-defense on the issue of initial aggressor. If you are claiming self-defense, you know whether you're the initial aggressor or not, and this court has said many times, if you're the initial aggressor, you don't enjoy self-defense. But if you are a third party who comes onto a scene and sees somebody being shot or beaten up or severely injured, does the law require you to stop the fight and inquire who started it before you act in defense of others? That seemed to be the trial prosecutor's position, but I would submit to you that's not correct. And I would submit that to you just from the basic plain language of NRS 200.160. Sub 1 says, in the lawful defense of the slayer or his or her husband, wife, et cetera, a homicide is also justifiable when there is reasonable ground to apprehend a design on the part of the person slain to commit a felony or to do some great personal injury to the slayer or to any such person, and there is an imminent danger of such design being accomplished. Relative to this case, I would note for what that statute does not say. It does not say that the person being slain is the initial aggressor or not. It's silent in that regard. And case law throughout the country, as particularly I've cited in the reply brief at pages 7 and 9, Silva and Mark, the Silva case and the Mark case, note that this is what distinguishes self-defense from defense of others. Defense of others, if you can come in and defend somebody who may have been the initial aggressor, the statute doesn't prohibit that. The law, the common law doesn't prohibit that. By the way, there's another distinction between self-defense and defense of others. Self-defense allows for a mistake of fact. As to the danger, I don't think defense of others realistically does. I don't know of any case that says otherwise. But it doesn't matter in this case. And it doesn't matter, I would submit to you, whether my client shoots Pettigrew intending to kill Pettigrew, or whether he shoots Pettigrew intending to kill Villagrana, but misses Villagrana and kisses and kills Pettigrew, because both of them are engaging clearly in acts of about to slay or do great personal injury to the slayer. Kicking somebody while they're down on the ground in the head and chest and neck certainly, I think, falls within that definition. So if a jury instruction is given that tracks the statute and makes clear that whether the person being killed is or is not the initial aggressor is irrelevant, that jury instruction can lead a reasonable jury to acquit. That jury instruction wasn't given in this case, however. In fact, the jury instruction given, jury instruction 34, made self-defense and defense of others interchangeable. And, of course, the DA, the trial prosecutor, jumped on that by arguing, what, 7 or 8 times to the jury why this case is not a self-defense case. I agree. It's not a self-defense case. That wasn't the defense of Mr. Gonzalez in any event. With respect to issue number 3, I would say this. If indeed it is plain reversible error per the Chapman Champion case of 1971 not to give an accomplice distrust instruction where the defendant is entitled to one, then Carter and Crawford apply. In other words, if the instruction tendered by trial counsel was not an accurate state of the law, I would submit per Champion, the judge would have to, be, a la Carter and Crawford, correct it to make it a correct statement of the law. And it wouldn't have been that hard to do because an accomplice distrust instruction depends on one thing. Is the witness an accomplice? Well, in this case, Rudnick certainly was. He was charged with the same crime as Gonzalez from the beginning. That makes him an accomplice.
Mr. Cornell, which counts are implicated by that claim? I don't think all the counts are.
Actually, certainly the counts that involve a conspiracy charge are, but the way the case was presented and argued, I think all of them are. That's my position. That
could you explain how so? I thought that argument would implicate counts 1, possibly 5, 6, and 7, but I wondered how they implicated the other counts, so perhaps you could explain that.
The state's theory in this case really rests on Rudnick. For the state to get a conviction, they have to convince the finder of fact that this was a conspiracy. They actually did that at the grand jury without Rudnick, just simply by presenting the code of the Vagos. But they have to do that for conspiracy purposes, and in this case, what Rudnick brings to the table that's critical is the meeting at 8 o'clock in the evening before the incident of the international.
Is Rudnick the only one who gives voice to that?
Is he the only one who gets points to that?
Gives voice to it. Who said that there was this meeting where they agreed that Pettigrew was going to have the green
absolutely.
Light on him?
Absolutely. Thank you. Absolutely. He is the most impeached witness on the cold record I think I've ever
but
seen.
But there's no one else who's...
No one else. Okay. You have... And he's contradicted by Evenson, who's the state's informant on that point. He's contradicted by Fern, by Seamer, by Nickerson, and actually even by the appellant himself. So... That's correct. Without him, there's no evidence of a before shooting.
But I interrupted your answer to Justice Hardesty's question, which is how does his testimony and the accomplice distrust instruction cut into, for example, the other counts?
Okay. Second-degree murder is clearly based on the conspiracy theory. No question about that. First-degree murder is based on the theory of lying in wait. He's lying in wait if he's not acting in defense of others. He's not acting in defense of others if he's in a conspiracy to kill. And that's why I asked the court, and the court granted the motion to get the thumb drive of Exhibit 151, because the position of the state on this is, well, Rudnick's testimony was corroborated. The part that's not in dispute, the part that we say shows the defense of others, indeed, is there in the video. But the fact that undisputed and not illegal per se evidence is corroborated doesn't mean you don't get the accomplice distrust instruction.
For example, and this one seems relatively straightforward to me, but maybe I'm missing something. Count 3 is one count of carrying a concealed weapon.
Oh, okay.
What is the accomplice testimony?
Doesn't cover that count. I agree with
and,
you.
And count 2, one count of challenge to fight resulting in death with the use of a deadly weapon. That doesn't seem to me to implicate Rudnick's significantly impeached testimony or the accomplice corroboration problem.
I agree with you on the first. The second one I don't, because challenge to fight, if you take Rudnick out of the picture, where did Gonzalez challenge anybody to fight, or where did anybody challenge Gonzalez to fight? The whole theory of Gonzalez being challenged to fight or being in part of the fight before it happens rests on this conspiracy.
What about count 4, one count of discharging a firearm in a structure?
Okay, that one, I would agree, doesn't implicate accomplice
discharge. But perhaps your argument concerning the defense of others would be a defense to that count.
It might. That's correct. And I could see...
So we'd approve of people shooting up the nugget in the defense of others.
Right. Well, under these circumstances... I know. But under these circumstances, I'm here to say yeah. In 30 seconds, if I could just quickly go through issues 4 and 5. I wish I had more time, but I don't. The bottom line of issues 4 and 5 are these. The question isn't whether the Vagos are a criminal gang with respect to the Hells Angels generally. The question is whether the San Jose Vagos are a criminal gang relative to the San Jose Hells Angels. That's what Jorge Gil Blanco testified to pre-trial, and it makes sense because the Hells Angels are not an international organization. They're chartered area by area. And secondly, since Gonzalez and Pettigrew had nothing to do with what happened in Scotts Valley, Arizona, San Bernardino, California, Clear Lake, California, and so forth, the evidence simply has no probative value on Gonzalez's motive on September 23, 2011. Therefore, if you agree with that, and I would submit that you should agree with that, that evidence could only come in a bifurcated proceeding after the guilt phase. Brought in the guilt phase, it has no relevance, but its prejudicial impact is enormous. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. I'm Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. And I guess if Mr. Cornell began with the philosophic observations, I will too. What the Convention of Visitors Authority does regarding the Hells Angels and the Vagos has no place before this court. It's irrelevant. And what would have happened in some other case with some other person also means absolutely nothing here. What is interesting about this is the only interesting part to me is the theory of defense instruction, because pretty well established case law, this court says, when there's a proper theory of defense instruction, the court ought to give it. However, it's harmless if it's adequately covered by other things. And in this case, it was more than harmless. It was beneficial to the defense because the defense of others instruction didn't require the defendant to stand in the shoes of the person being rescued, which this court has required in Batson. That is, you cannot use any greater force, any degree of force that the person being rescued could not use. So he escaped by the instruction actually given. Gonzalez escaped that limitation and was able to raise his defense, not successfully because it wasn't believed. But that goes only to the prejudice aspect of the theory of defense instruction. More interesting is whether this court should revisit the question that has been answered so many times. And I suggest you ought to overrule the line of cases, which includes the case I refer to as the Brooks Brothers, is 1986 decision about mere presence in a drug sales case. And I say that because if we back these cases up to the origins of the doctrine, what we find is that it's not really required. That is, it's a good idea. But all that is required is sufficient instructions to allow the defense attorney and the prosecutor to argue their case. There ought not to be a requirement that the district court judge identify and potentially give credence to some specific theory of defense. Instead, the instructions ought to be sufficient only to allow the defense attorney to do that. Now, I draw that from the decision of this court, early 90s, I think. It's In re Sean M. Happened to be an incredibly good-looking public defender that argued that case. That was me, of course. But in that, the trial judge had refused to allow closing arguments. And what this court said is the purpose of closing arguments is to clarify and refine the issues. And I agree with that sentiment. That's what it is. That's where it ought to be. And that's where the duty ought to lie, is with the defense attorney and with the prosecutor, not with the judge. So I ask this court to revisit that line of cases and recognize that all that is really required is to give sufficient instructions to allow the lawyers to argue their case. The judge should not be part of that argument and certainly shouldn't give credence to any part of it. So,
Mr. McCarthy, I have a question about the accomplice theory or the issues that surround the accomplice testimony precisely. that would you agree, number one, that Rudnick is the only one who, as Justice Pickering said, informs or gives voice to the conspiracy theory?
My recollection, he's the only witness that directly mentioned it.
So in that regard, would you also agree that his testimony in this case had a plea agreement wrapped around it that required him to testify against or on behalf of the state in Mr. Gonzalez's case?
My recollection is it required him to testify.
Testify, honestly.
The jury, of course, was informed of every aspect of it. And the proffered instruction included the factual finding that he was expecting something in return.
I get all that. I was leading up to my question, which is, therefore, don't we have a problem in this case with the accomplice instruction, the lack thereof, with all of the discussion about the fact that he informs the entire conspiracy charge? Were those related thereto?
I don't think so. I think that we often leave it to the jury to determine what weight to give to any witness, whether it's an accomplice or not. And when there is sufficient corroboration, there really isn't a need for an instruction at all.
Well, in this case, you've acknowledged that there was no corroboration.
No, there's no corroboration of that. The court may recall the Gallego case. Gerald Gallego was found 100 miles away the day after the murder with a rope similar to that used by the killer. That is sufficient corroboration of his involvement in the murder.
None of which is present here.
Well, he's present, and there's a video of him shooting someone. That's pretty good corroboration, I'd say.
Well, I'm talking about what I'd like to know about is the corroboration as to the accomplice's testimony. That you're conceding that was uncorroborated.
Well, there are elements of that testimony that are uncorroborated. That has never been the rule. The everything the accomplice says must be corroborated. Instead, there must be independent
evidence.
I'm sorry?
Just to show a conspiracy had occurred.
Well, the actions in connection with each other is also evidence of the conspiracy. This was the only direct evidence of the conspiracy.
What are the other actions?
Well, the forming of the gauntlet, so to speak, where people acting in concert. You may conclude from that they intend to act in concert when they do. And so that those sort of things show that there is an agreement. In fact, as Mr. Cornell pointed out, the indictment didn't include the testimony of Rudnick, and the grand jury still found the conspiracy to exist.
Was there any type of testimony from any of the experts that this was part of their ritual or their when they get together at these conventions?
I don't recall any testimony like that. There would be how to respond to disrespect. So in a more general term, the answer is yes, but I don't think there was any testimony about what one does when one stays at the wrong hotel. Nothing that specific.
And then doesn't that sort of feed into your opposing colleague's point that the district court has discretion whether to answer a jury question, but the question to do with whether or not the shooter had to know of the conspiracy rather than just be an unwitting actor, shouldn't that have been answered? And combined with the lack of the accomplice distrust instruction on this conspiracy issue, doesn't that suggest that there may be truly something there?
Well, it suggests that one juror had...
Well, we don't know that it's one juror or many. I mean, that...
It was phrased that way.
But one juror could, armed with a legal statement that the answer to that question is no, sway the other jurors. So I'm not convinced you can marginalize one juror.
Well, I agree with that. I'm not suggesting that merely because it was from one juror, not from the jury as a whole, that the analysis is different. What I'm suggesting is the district court judge could conclude, could be of the opinion, that this is, the kid at the end of the class that always wants to talk, that always wants to ask a question just to hear himself speak, that there was no actual question. Furthermore, while I agree, the instinctive response is to just say no.
That was your trial deputy's response as well.
It was. And And that's, that would also have been appropriate. Problem here is we instruct these jurors, among other things, to consider the instructions as a whole. And yet, if we take this one and we answer it, say, no, it's absolutely not, it kind of undermines that. So the appropriate instruction is the appropriate response, or one of the appropriate responses, is read them. Read them all, and read them all together.
Do you think 17 unequivocally, either alone or in combination with the others, gave that straightforward answer to that question?
I'm sorry, instruction 17? Yes, I think that the instructions are clear enough that they all have to be read in conjunction.
Clear enough, but not crystal clear.
I've never seen a crystal clear instruction.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough.
Well, the instruction wasn't settled until at the end of the trial. At least that's how we did in Clark County. Did they settle the instructions before so that the judge would know that that instruction was going to be given? Did not answer the question?
The instructions were settled towards the end of the trial.
But the question was asked before that.
No, this was while the jury was deliberating.
Oh, while they're deliberating.
Yes, I believe that's, yes. So it could happen. In general, when we get in, we don't, how do I say this, we don't invite a free-range discussion with jurors. You give them one set of written instructions, and that ought to be the end of it. But if the judge is of the opinion, if there's a question that comes out, and if the trial judge is of the opinion that things are not clear, then the court can correct it. But if the judge is of the opinion that they are clear, and that's the phrasing this court used in Tellus, if the trial judge is of the opinion that the instructions are sufficiently clear, that the judge does not have to respond in any specific way, but can just refer the jurors back to the instructions. And those instructions were clear enough that knowledge, of course, is an element of the instruction of the conspiracy. And I think the fact that there were no further questions, that there was no follow-up, ought to help this court, if there's any question about it, to conclude that ultimately the jury concluded correctly that the conspiracy was defined in the instructions.
What is the failure to answer that question due to the presumption that the jury followed the instructions? I mean, you just sort of touched on that, but the fact that they're questioning, they've already been instructed to read the instructions as a whole, not single anyone out, you know, et cetera, apply common sense, but they still had a question that they sent out, and then the judge declines to answer it. Well, sort of sua sponde, because as I read the record, the state agreed the question should have been answered, no.
I think we're left with the presumption that the jurors followed all the instructions.
So in your position, it doesn't affect the presumption that they followed the instructions were correct, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't think it has any effect on the presumption. We would presume that the jurors followed all the instructions, including that one, including the one to go back and read all the instructions together. As they should have in the first place.
Of course, they also had a question about first and second degree murder. So I'm sort of with Justice Pickering here on whether or not we can rely on the presumption that they read and understood the instructions.
I think in that case, the question, the response, and the verdict shows that they were listening. Because the trial judge pointed out, contrary to what the prosecutor said, that second degree murder was not presented as a lesser included charge. It was presented as a charged crime. And the answer was yes. Return a verdict on every count in the indictment. And they did. I think that just supports the notion that jurors follow their instructions.
Well, Mr. McCarthy, I'd like to return to the question about whether an accomplice's testimony needs to be corroborated. Your view is it does not.
The prior opinions of this court have not required that all of an accomplice's testimony be corroborated, that there must be enough to independently connect the accused with the crime. Now, the crime here, certainly there's sufficient corroboration of murder by virtue of shooting that fellow. But this court has never required that any specific part of an accomplice's testimony be corroborated.
How do you reconcile that and the absence of the cautionary instruction with Buckley versus State?
I got to say, I'm not familiar with, I'm not following.
Well, my belief is that Buckley stands for the proposition that the failure to give a cautionary instruction is reversible error where the informant witness's testimony is uncorroborated.
And I tend to agree, although I don't think it ought to be reversible error. I think we ought to leave it to the jury to decide what weight to give to anyone's testimony, including an accomplice. And I think it ought to be up to the lawyers to make that argument, not to the judge. But, again, the court has never required that everything be corroborated.
Well, in this instance, the one significant piece of information that is uncorroborated is the conspiracy that Rutnick claims existed with Gonzalez, or to kill Gonzalez.
Well, I disagree that it's uncorroborated.
Sorry?
I disagree that the existence of the conspiracy is not corroborated.
Why don't you lay out the facts that you're relying upon then?
The people acting in concert. They formed the gauntlet, and then there's testimony of the challenges, and don't let this guy through, and there's...
But does that go to the issue of actually killing, opposed to the respect issue?
It goes to the existence of the conspiracy. When people act in concert, one may conclude that they have conspired. And
conspired to kill, or just conspired to be in the same place at the same time?
It's a question of how much corroboration do we require. Every word? I don't think so. It's enough to connect the accused to the crime. And I think there's more than enough. And this is one of those very odd occasions where I've used all my time. But I'm willing to stand here as long as you're willing to listen.
Any other questions for Mr. McCarthy? Okay, then I guess we're done here, Mr. McCarthy. And thank you, Mr. Cornell, for your arguments. And the always a pleasure to hear both of you argue your cases, and your briefs are well written. This case will stand submitted. Thank you.